A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, a hypothetical about someone whose parents controlled what they wore from childhood, buying everything, vetoing their choices, and how that person might reach adulthood, feeling like their sense of fashion was never really their own. The question is, how would you recommend they start figuring out what they actually want to wear, so they feel like themselves in their clothes?
This is such a rich question because it's not really about clothes. It's about autonomy, and it's about something psychologists call enclothed cognition. The idea that what we wear doesn't just signal identity to other people, it actually shapes our own cognitive processes. Yeah, the term comes from a 2012 study by Hajo Adam and Adam Galinsky at Northwestern. They gave participants a white lab coat and told some of them it was a doctor's coat, and told others it was a painter's coat. The group who thought they were wearing a doctor's coat performed significantly better on attention tasks. They literally embodied the symbolic properties of the clothing. What we wear changes how we think.
The person in our hypothetical isn't just missing a look. They're missing a cognitive tool.
And if your parents dictated that tool your whole life, you've been wearing someone else's cognitive framework. That's not just an aesthetic problem, it's almost an epistemic one.
There's a boutique concept.
The hipster Berlin storefront writes itself. But seriously, the first thing I'd tell this person is, you're not starting from zero, you're starting from a negative. You don't just lack a personal style, you've internalized someone else's as the default. So step one is recognizing that the voice in your head that says, that's not you, when you pick something up, might not be your voice at all.
That's a good distinction. How do you separate the two?
There's a practical exercise that stylists and therapists who work in this space recommend. Go to a clothing store. Doesn't have to be expensive, a thrift store is actually better for this, and pick out three things you're drawn to and three things you're repelled by. Don't analyze why yet. Then, for each one, ask yourself, is this reaction mine, or am I hearing my mother's voice, or my father's?
That color is too loud. Whose sentence is that?
And sometimes it is yours. Sometimes you genuinely don't like loud colors. But you have to audit the reaction. The goal isn't to rebel against everything your parents chose, that's just being controlled in reverse. The goal is to figure out which preferences are actually yours.
The negative space approach. Define yourself by what you're not, then work inward.
And this connects to a broader concept in identity formation. There's a whole body of work on how parental control over self-expression in childhood affects adult decision-making. A 2019 study in the Journal of Family Psychology found that adults who reported high levels of parental control over personal choices, including clothing, showed lower identity coherence, meaning they had a harder time articulating who they were and what they valued. It's not just taste, it's self-concept.
The stakes are higher than, I don't know what jeans to buy.
And I think that's what makes the prompt so good. It's asking about fashion, but it's really asking, how do you build a self when someone else has been doing the building?
Let's get practical then. Walk me through the process. Someone's listening. They're in their late 20s, 30s, 40s. They've never chosen their own clothes in a meaningful way. What's the first thing they do on a Saturday morning?
Okay, so I've thought about this. I'd break it into phases. Phase one is what I'd call the data collection phase. Before you buy anything, before you even try anything on, you spend time just looking, not shopping, looking. Pinterest boards, Instagram, people, watching at a cafe, flipping through magazines if those still exist. Save images of outfits that make you feel something, not outfits you think you should like, not outfits your parents would approve of. Outfits that produce a gut reaction.
The gut reaction is the compass.
It's the only compass you've got at this stage, and it's probably been miscalibrated by years of external input. But you have to trust it anyway. Collect, say, 50 images. Then look for patterns. What keeps showing up? Is it loose silhouettes? Texture over pattern? You're looking for the through line.
This is basically qualitative coding. You're doing thematic analysis on your own taste.
That's exactly what it is. And it's important to do this before you spend a single dollar, because the impulse, when you finally have freedom, is to buy everything that catches your eye, and you end up with a closet full of pieces that don't go together and don't feel like you.
The pendulum swing problem. You've been restricted, so you overcorrect into chaos.
Then you feel worse, because now the chaos feels like proof that you don't know what you're doing. So phase one is entirely no purchase, just looking and pattern spotting.
What about the person who doesn't trust their gut reaction? I'm thinking of someone who's been so thoroughly conditioned that even the act of saving images that produce a feeling sends them into a spiral of second-guessing. Like, do I actually like this, or do I just think I should like it because it's what the algorithm is showing me?
That's a real concern, and it's where the exercise needs a slight modification. For the person who can't access their gut reaction directly, I'd suggest a workaround. Instead of asking, do I like this? Ask, does this image make me want to be the person in it? It's a slightly different question, and it bypasses the approval, seeking filter a bit. Because you're not evaluating the outfit, you're evaluating the feeling the outfit produces about a possible version of yourself.
That's a clever sidestep. You're not judging the clothes, you're judging the aspiration.
Aspirations are harder to police. Your mother's voice might say that skirt is too short, but is less equipped to say you're not allowed to want to be the kind of person who wears that skirt. It's a subtle shift, but for some people it's the difference between a blank Pinterest board and one that actually has some data on it.
What if even that feels like too much? What if looking at images of other people just reinforces the sense of, I don't know who I am?
Then you go even more basic. Forget images of other people entirely. Instead, spend a week paying attention to what you notice in the world. Not fashion, just sensory preferences. What colors do your eyes linger on when you walk down the street? What textures do you reach for without thinking? Do you gravitate toward the smooth ceramic mug or the rough earthenware one? These micro preferences are the raw material of taste. They're pre-verbal, pre-judgment. And they're yours.
You're building a preference profile from the ground up. Not what do I want to wear, but what do I already demonstrably like in the world?
And if you collect enough of those data points, patterns emerge. You might notice you consistently choose matte over shiny, or warm tones over cool, or organic shapes over geometric ones. None of that is clothing yet, but it's the foundation. It's the geological layer beneath style.
I love that. The geology of taste. So you're saying even someone who feels completely disconnected from their own preferences can start by just noticing what they notice?
That's the bedrock. And the beautiful thing is, nobody can tell you you're wrong about whether you like the rough mug or the smooth one. It's not a matter of opinion, it's just a fact about you.
Okay, so let's say they've done the data collection. Whether through images, or sensory noticing, or some combination, they've got their 50 images or their preference log.
Phase two is what I'd call the capsule experiment. Pick 3 to 5 pieces based on the patterns you identified, and here's the key. Wear only those pieces for 2 weeks.
A fashion elimination diet.
And the reason is twofold. First, constraint forces clarity. When you have fewer choices, you pay more attention to how each piece makes you feel. Second, it simulates the experience of actually living in your choices, not just trying them on in a fitting room. The fitting room is a terrible place to evaluate clothing. The lighting is weird, you're in a hurry, and you're still in the mindset of, would someone else approve of this?
The fitting room is basically a panopticon.
The fitting room as Foucauldian surveillance. I need to write that paper. The 2-week wear test is where you find out if that oversized linen shirt actually fits your life, or if you're just in love with the idea of being a person who wears oversized linen.
What are you tracking during those 2 weeks?
1. Physical comfort. Does the fabric feel good? Does the fit let you move? Are you adjusting it constantly? 2. Emotional comfort. Do you feel like yourself, or do you feel like you're wearing a costume? And 3. Social feedback. Not in a seek approval way, but notice how people respond. Do you get comments? Do you feel more or less visible? That's data, not a grade.
The social feedback piece is tricky, though. If you've been conditioned to seek parental approval, you might just be swapping one external validator for another.
That's a real risk. And I think the safeguard is to treat social feedback as information, not instruction. If 3 people independently tell you that a particular color makes you look alive, that's worth noting. If 1 person says they don't like your jacket, that's 1 person's opinion. You're building a dashboard, not taking orders.
I like that. Multiple gauges, no single authority.
The most important gauge is the one labeled how I feel when I'm not thinking about how I look. The best outfit is the one you forget you're wearing.
That's a high bar, though. Especially for someone who's been hyper-aware of clothing their whole life because it was always being evaluated.
It is a high bar. And you don't hit it in 2 weeks. This is a months-long process, maybe years. But you can get closer incrementally. The first time you go a whole day without thinking about your clothes, that's a milestone.
I want to push on the capsule experiment a bit, because I think there's a hidden challenge here. 3 to 5 pieces for 2 weeks. That's a very small wardrobe. What if the person picks wrong? What if they get to day 4 and realize they've chosen pieces that make them actively uncomfortable, and now they're stuck in a self-imposed uniform that feels awful?
That's not a bug, that's a feature. Finding out you hate something is as valuable as finding out you love it. Maybe more valuable, because the things you hate are often the things you are told to like. If you get to day 4 and the blazer you picked makes you feel like you're cosplaying a board meeting, that's a revelation. Write it down. Blazers make me feel like an imposter. That's gold. That's a data point you didn't have before.
The discomfort is the point.
The discomfort is the curriculum. And you're not actually stuck. You can modify the experiment midstream. Swap out the blazer for a cardigan or a denim jacket. The constraint is there to generate information, not to punish you. The rule is, learn something, not suffer for 2 weeks.
That's an important clarification, because I can imagine someone with a controlling parent background being especially prone to following rules to the letter, even self-imposed ones, even to their own detriment.
And that's the meta lesson, right? Learning when to break your own rules is part of developing autonomy. If you've internalized a controlling parent, you might also internalize a controlling inner stylist who says no, you committed to the capsule, you have to finish it. That voice is also not your friend.
The inner stylist as the parent in disguise. The layers on this thing.
It's turtles all the way down. But that's why I emphasize documentation throughout. When you write down, I changed the experiment because the blazer made me miserable, you're practicing self-authorship. You're saying, I made a plan, I got new information, I revised the plan. That's what autonomous adults do.
We've got data collection, capsule experiment with built-in permission to revise. What's phase 3?
Phase 3 is what I'd call the silhouette lock-in. By now you've identified, let's say, 2 or 3 silhouettes that feel like you. Maybe it's high-waisted trousers with a fitted top. Maybe it's an A-line dress with a crop jacket. Whatever it is, you now know your shapes. And that's when you can start building a real wardrobe, because silhouette is the architecture of personal style. Color and pattern are decoration. Silhouette is the foundation.
Most people start with color. I'm a winter. I'm an autumn.
Which is backward. Color seasons are useful, don't get me wrong, but they're a refinement tool. They're something you apply after you know your shapes. If you don't know your silhouette, you can be wearing the perfect shade of olive and still feel like you're in someone else's clothes.
Because the shape is the grammar. Color is vocabulary.
And if you get the grammar right, the vocabulary can be simple. You can wear the same silhouette in 5 colors and it looks intentional, not boring.
Can we talk about how someone figures out their silhouette? Because I think a lot of people don't think in those terms. They think I like this shirt, or I like this dress, not I like the relationship between the volume on top and the volume on bottom.
And it's where the earlier image collection becomes useful again. Go back to those 50 images you saved. This time, don't look at the colors or the patterns or the vibe. Look only at the shapes. Trace the outline of each outfit with your eye. Is the top voluminous and the bottom narrow? Is it narrow all the way down? Is there a defined waist? Are the shoulders emphasized? You'll start to see that most of the images you saved share 1 or 2 basic shape relationships.
You're abstracting away from the specific items to the geometry underneath.
And once you see the geometry, you can replicate it with completely different pieces. A voluminous top over narrow bottom could be a chunky sweater and slim jeans, or it could be an oversized blazer and a pencil skirt, or a billowy blouse and tapered trousers. Different items, same silhouette. That's how you build a wardrobe that feels coherent without being a uniform.
Which brings us to the emotional side of this, because I imagine there's grief involved. When you realize you've spent 20 years in someone else's aesthetic, there's a loss to process.
I think that's almost always present and almost never discussed. There's a mourning period. You're mourning the years you didn't get to express yourself. and you might also be mourning the relationship with the parent, because once you start dressing for yourself, they're probably going to notice, and they might not like it.
Then you're right back in the dynamic that created the problem in the first place.
Which is why I'd recommend this person have a support system in place before they start. A friend who gets it. Maybe a therapist if the parental dynamic was particularly controlling. Because the first time you show up to a family dinner in something you chose, and your mother says that's interesting, you need someone to debrief with afterward.
The mom word for, I hate it, but I know I'm not supposed to say that.
The most devastating word in the parental vocabulary. And if you're not prepared for it, it can send you right back into the old patterns. You'll find yourself back at the mall buying beige cardigans.
The beige cardigan as surrender.
It's the white flag of personal style. And look, I'm not saying beige cardigans are bad. If beige cardigans are your thing, wear them with joy. But if they're the thing you reach for when you're trying to be invisible and acceptable, that's not style. That's camouflage.
There's an interesting distinction there between invisibility and camouflage. Invisibility is, I don't want to be seen. Camouflage is, I want to be seen as acceptable, as normal, as fitting in. One is about absence, the other is about conformity.
That's a really useful distinction. And I think the person in our hypothetical has probably spent a lot of time in camouflage mode, not trying to disappear entirely, but trying to appear in the specific way that avoids comment. The beige cardigan isn't about hiding. It's about signaling nothing to criticize here.
Which is its own kind of exhausting performance.
Exhausting and invisible to most people, which makes it lonely. You're doing all this work to appear unremarkable, and nobody even knows you're doing it. Meanwhile, you're dying inside because the real you has never been seen.
How do you handle the family dinner moment?
You prepare a response in advance, something that acknowledges the comment without engaging the criticism. I'm trying something new is good. I feel great in this is better because it recenters your experience. And then you change the subject. You don't defend. You don't explain. You don't justify. Those are traps.
Don't defend. Don't explain. Don't justify. That's basically the gray rock method applied to clothing.
And it works for the same reason. It denies the critic the engagement they're seeking. Your mother's interesting is often an invitation to a conversation where you're expected to concede that she knows better. You just don't RSVP.
What about the follow-up, though? Because in my experience, interesting is rarely the end of the conversation. It's the opening move. Next comes, where did you get that? Or is that what people are wearing now? Or the classic,
it's very you. Said with the precise intonation that makes you sound like a questionable life choice. You're right, the follow-up is coming, and I think the key is to have a second line ready. Something that closes the door without slamming it. I've been experimenting with some new things, and I'm really enjoying it. Past tense, enjoying. It signals this is a settled state, not up for debate. And then you immediately pivot to something about them. How's the garden? People love to talk about themselves.
I'm enjoying it. How's the garden? That's a complete conversational jujitsu move.
It works because most critical parents aren't actually interested in a sustained debate about your clothing. They want to register their disapproval and have it acknowledged. If you don't acknowledge it, they'll often move on because the alternative, explicitly demanding you justify your outfit, would make them look controlling. Which they are, but they don't want to look that way.
Let's talk about the practical barriers, though. Money, for one. Experimenting with style costs money, and not everyone has a clothing budget for self-discovery.
This is where thrift stores and clothing swaps are transformative, and I don't mean that in a bootstrap your way to self-actualization way. I mean that the economics of this process are real, and the solution is to decouple experimentation from investment. You should not be spending significant money on phase two. The capsule experiment should cost you, ideally, under $100 total. Less if you're strategic.
Rental platforms are an option now, too.
Clothing rental has exploded. You can rent a piece for a month, wear it in real life, and send it back. That's a low-stakes way to test a silhouette or a color you're not sure about. It's like dating before marriage.
The Tinder approach to trousers.
Swipe right on the wide leg linen. And the other practical barrier is body image. If your parents controlled your clothing, they probably also sent messages about your body. What should be covered? What should be emphasized? What should be hidden? Unpacking that is a whole separate layer.
The clothing is just the visible part of a much deeper conditioning about how you're allowed to take up space.
And I think for a lot of people in this hypothetical, the first time they put on something that feels like them, there's a visceral reaction, not always positive. Sometimes it's, I can't wear this. I'm not the kind of person who wears this. Which is the internalized parent talking.
I'm not the kind of person who wears this. That sentence does so much work.
It's the whole problem in 8 words. And the antidote is to wear it anyway. Wear it around the house first. Wear it to the grocery store. Build evidence that the world doesn't end when you wear something your parents wouldn't have chosen.
Exposure therapy for fashion.
That's literally what it is. And it works on the same principles. Gradual exposure, starting in low-stakes environments, building toward higher-stakes ones. The family dinner is the final boss, not the tutorial level.
I want to zoom in on the body image layer because I think it deserves more airtime. If your parents controlled your clothing, they probably weren't neutral about your body. There were likely explicit or implicit messages. That draws attention to your hips. You need to cover your arms. That makes you look bigger. How do you even begin to separate your actual body preferences from those implanted critiques?
That's one of the hardest layers to peel back, because body image messages are absorbed so early and so deeply that they feel like objective truth. My arms look bad feels like a fact about the world, not a sentence someone taught you. And I think the first step is simply to notice when those thoughts arise and ask, when did I first believe this? Can I trace it to a specific comment? A specific person?
The genealogy of the body critique.
And sometimes you can trace it. My mother told me I had thick ankles when I was 12, and I've avoided ankle straps ever since. Once you can see the origin, the rule starts to look less like wisdom and more like a grudge you've been carrying for someone else.
What if he can't trace it? What if it's just ambient? A whole family culture of body commentary that didn't come from a single comment, but from 1,000 micro-expressions.
Then you approach it behaviorally instead of genealogically. You do the thing that scares you and see what happens. Wear the ankle straps. Wear the sleeveless top. Wear the thing that draws attention. And then pay attention to what actually happens. Not what you fear will happen, what actually happens. Do people stare? Do they comment? Or do they just... Most of the time, the catastrophe exists only in the anticipation.
If someone does comment, if a family member says, "Are you sure you want to wear that with your figure?"
then you've caught them in the act. They've revealed that the voice in your head isn't paranoid. It's an accurate recording of an external critic. And that's painful, but it's also clarifying. Because now you can see the enemy. It's not your body. It's their commentary. And you can decide, consciously, that their commentary is not your problem.
"Not my problem" is a muscle that needs building.
It's atrophied in people who grew up with controlling parents. The muscle of that sounds like a you problem. But you can build it. And clothing is a surprisingly good gym for that workout, because it's a daily practice. Every time you choose not to change your outfit in response to an internalized critique, you do one rep.
We've talked about the process, the psychology, the family dynamics. What about the end state? How does this person know they've arrived?
I don't think "arrived" is quite the right framing. Personal style isn't a destination, it's a practice. But I think there's a shift that happens. The shift is from, "What should I wear?" to, "What do I want to wear?" and eventually to just reaching for something without thinking about it at all. When you get dressed in the morning and the question isn't, "Is this me?" but "What's the weather?" that's when you know you've internalized your own taste.
The weather test. If your primary clothing decision is about temperature and occasion rather than identity, you're there.
That's a beautiful thing. It means clothing has become functional again. Not in a boring way, in the way that it's doing its job. It's expressing something about you while you're focused on living your life.
Which circles back to enclosed cognition. The clothes are working for you, not the other way around.
That's exactly the goal. The lab coat study I mentioned, those participants didn't think about the coat, they just performed better. The coat was doing cognitive work in the background. That's what good personal style does. It operates below conscious awareness, shaping how you think and how you move through the world without requiring constant attention.
There's a paradox there. The whole process we've described is incredibly conscious. Auditing, documenting, experimenting, tracking. And the goal of all that consciousness is to reach a state where you don't have to be conscious about it anymore.
That's the paradox of skill acquisition in general. You practice scales so you can improvise. You drill grammar so you can speak without thinking about conjugation. The conscious effort builds the unconscious competence. Style is no different. You do the awkward, self-aware work so that eventually, getting dressed becomes as unremarkable as making coffee.
I'm reminded of something a musician once told me. Amateurs practice until they get it right. Professionals practice until they can't get it wrong. Is that the aspiration here?
I'd soften it a bit. Can't get it wrong implies there's a single right answer, and I don't think there is. I'd say the aspiration is, can't feel wrong to yourself. You practice until your own choices feel natural, even if they look strange to someone else. The goal isn't objective correctness, it's subjective ease.
The process is, externalize the internalized voice, collect data on your own reactions, experiment cheaply, lock in silhouettes, handle the family pushback, and keep going until you're dressing for the weather.
That's the map. And I'd add one more thing. Document the process. Take photos of outfits you feel good in, not for social media, for yourself. Because there will be days when you feel lost again, when you try something and it doesn't work, when your mother's voice creeps back in. Having a visual record of times you got it right is an anchor.
Your own lookbook as evidence of self.
And it's also just a joy. Looking back at a photo from 6 months ago and thinking, I looked great that day, and I chose that. That's a small but real form of self-trust.
There's something almost political about this, isn't there? Reclaiming your own body as a site of decision-making.
It is political, especially for women, but not only for women. The control of appearance is one of the most intimate forms of control there is. Reclaiming it is an act of sovereignty.
It's not about rejecting everything your parents ever taught you. That's an important nuance. Some of their tastes might actually align with yours.
This isn't a scorched earth exercise. The point is choice, not opposition. If you go through the whole process and discover that you love the kind of clothes your parents picked, great, now it's yours. Now you're choosing it. That's the difference between a tradition and a prison.
The difference between inheritance and imposition.
Inheritance is received and made your own. Imposition is received and never questioned.
I want to sit with that distinction for a second because I think it's one of the most important ideas in this whole conversation. Inheritance implies you can accept or refuse. You can take the pieces that fit and leave the rest. Imposition doesn't give you that option. And a lot of people in this situation probably grew up thinking they were receiving an inheritance. Were teaching you how to dress properly, when they were actually receiving an imposition.
That reframe is itself liberating. To realize that what you experienced wasn't guidance, it was control. That's a painful recognition, but it's also the moment when the whole project starts to make sense. You're not ungrateful for wanting to dress yourself. You're not rejecting wisdom. You're converting an imposition into an inheritance by finally exercising the choice that was denied you.
For the person listening who's in this situation, what's the one thing they should do tomorrow?
Tomorrow morning, they should open a note on their phone or grab a notebook and write down every clothing rule they absorbed growing up, not to follow or to break, just to see it on the page. No bright colors. Always dress modestly. That pattern is too busy. You have to wear a belt. Whatever the rules were, write them all down, and then look at the list and ask, which of these do I actually believe?
That's a powerful exercise. The rules lose their power when you drag them into the light.
Because most of them are absurd when you see them written out. No horizontal stripes. What catastrophe are we preventing here?
The great stripe disaster of whenever.
And once you've laughed at a rule, it's hard to take it seriously again.
That's the starting point. Audit the rules, collect the images, run the capsule experiment, lock in the silhouettes, handle the family, document the wins.
This took years to build. It takes time to unbuild.
If you cry in a fitting room at some point, that's probably a good sign.
It really is. It means you're feeling something, which means you're alive to your own preferences. That's the whole point.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1960s, Honduran carpenters called their wooden-handled claw hammers martillo de uña de gato, literally cat's claw hammer, not for the nail-pulling claw, but because the handle's ergonomic curve was shaped to mimic the arc of a stretching cat's paw, a design choice borrowed from traditional Mayan woodworking tools.
I now want a hammer named after a cat.
You'll find one, and it'll be your whole personality for 3 weeks.
I make no apologies.
The question we didn't quite answer is whether this process ever really ends. I suspect it doesn't. Style evolves because you evolve. The person you are at 30 is not the person you are at 50. So maybe the real skill isn't finding your style. It's learning how to listen to yourself as you change.
The process is the skill. Once you know how to audit your preferences, how to experiment, how to distinguish your voice from the inherited ones, you have that tool for life. The wardrobe changes, but the self-awareness doesn't.
That's probably the deeper gift. You started trying to figure out what to wear, and you ended up figuring out who you are.
Which is why the prompt matters. It's dressed as a fashion question, but it's really a question about autonomy. And the answer, in a sentence, is, you build it the way you build anything, slowly, deliberately, and with the understanding that the person you're dressing is worth the effort.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts.
If you enjoyed this one, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more than you'd think.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.